Welcome to the Shir in Ibn Ezra, Parshas Baalotcha. So tonight a number of sundry, various and sundry Ibn Ezra's, not connected to one another unless you have some amazing shot and you can somehow link them all up together. But if you have that, I don't. So we're just going to present different insights from the Ibn Ezra on the Parshas HaShavua. Sedra starts off by Dabra Hashem Al Shalemar, Dabra Al Aram V'Maitre Love. Speak to Aaron and tell him when you raise up the lights of the menorah, etc. Clearly, Aaron is being charged with kindling the menorah. And Ibn Ezra makes a seemingly innocent comment on this line. Zaber of Aaron, why should Aaron be the one spoken to? Because it is he, Aaron HaKohen, who is charged, who is obligated with the mitzvah of lighting the menorah in the Mishkan, and presumably his descendants are charged with that mitzvah in the Beit HaMikdash. It seems like an innocent enough remark, but the truth is, Ibn Ezra may be wading right into the middle of a major machlokes or rishonim. The Gemara says in Yuma, we had it earlier when we learned the Sechta Yuma, that hadlaka shera bizar, or I should take that back, hadlaka lava vodi, that the lighting of the menorah is not considered to be a menorah, is not considered to be an avodah, it's not something which is one of the tasks with which the Kohanim are tasked. And the implication seems to be that it's not a job uniquely set up for the Kohen. Here we come upon an interesting machlokes between the Rambam and the Raizit. The Rambam writes, in Hilchos Bias HaMikdash Perek Tes Halacha Zayin, the Chen had Lokas HaNeiros Shera Bezorim. The Rambam writes explicitly that lighting the menorah in the Beit HaMikdash is an activity that a Zor, a non-Kohen, is allowed to perform. Lefikach, therefore, says the Rambam, in Heitiv HaKohen HaNeiros, if the Kohen cleaned out the lights of the menorah, the receptacles of the menorah, both Sion Lachutz, and the Kohen were to then take the menorah and bring it outside of the Azara, outside of the courtyard, because after all, the area where the menorah is set up in the Kodesh is inaccessible to anyone but a Kohen. So if the Kohen were to take the menorah and bring it outside of the Mikdash of the Azara, in a place where Azara would be able to access it, Mutar Lazar Lahadli come. A Zohar would be permitted, l'chatchila, according to the Rambam, to light the menorah. In other words, hadlaka lava vodahi, the fact that the hadlaka, the lighting of the menorah, is not considered to be an avodah, that fact allows a Zohar, l'chatchila, mankar, l'chatchila, to light the menorah. On this Rambam, the Raizit comments, Amar Avraham, Hiflid, Kisha Omar Mutar Lazar Lahadlika. The Rambam went too far when he allowed a non-Kohen to light the menorah. Ella Sheim Hiblikon Shera. All the Gemara means when it says that if the Havlaka is not considered to be an Avoda, all it means is that it's kosher. The lighting of the menorah is considered acceptable to the Eved if it was done by a Zohar, but certainly, l'chatchila, a Zohar should not be lighting the menorah. The Chaim Soloveitchik in his Sefer on the Rambam points out, or suggests, that perhaps even according to the Rambam, under normal circumstances, the calling l'chatchila is supposed to light the menorah. Right, the Rambam writes, the Rambam describes the case where the Zohar lights the menorah as where the menorah was removed from the mikdash and brought to the outside. Now, why is that the case that the Rambam is mitzayir? Why does the Rambam present that particular case? So the simple pshat is because that's the only case in which the Zohar would have access to into the menorah. Otherwise, the Tzar may be allowed to light the menorah fundamentally, but he can't get into the place where the menorah is. He can't get into the Kodesh in order to be able to light it. The Chaim, however, suggests within the Rambam that perhaps the Rambam means something else as well. Perhaps when the Tzar goes into the Kodesh, he's not simply in violation of going to a place where he doesn't belong, but when the menorah is in its proper place, there the mitzvah is for a kohen to light it. The only time that a Tzar has the ability to light it, not just the logistic ability to light it, but even the halakhic ability to light it, is where the menorah has been removed from its proper place, and since it's out of its place, that is matir the Tzar l'chatzila to light it. In any case, the Ibn Ezra seems very much to be siding with the Ravid in this machlokas between the Rambam and the Ravid. Again, the Ibn Ezra rather writes, why is the mitzvah of lighting the menorah addressed to Aaron? Ki hu chayov, the mitzvah machlokas haner, because he is the one who's obligated to light the menorah. The Rambam would not have said that. Again, perhaps the Rambam might have said that according to Reb Chaim's interpretation of the Rambam, but the simple shot in the Rambam is that no, it's not the case that Aaron or his sons, that the Kohanim, are chayovim in hadlokas haner. Anyone could light the ner. Anyone could light the menorah. A Zohar could light the menorah as well. So it's not the case that only Kohanim are higher than the Hadlokas on the Norah. The Ibn Ezra, without really telling you much, seems to be siding with the position of the Ravid against that of the Rambam. Parenthetically, how does the Rambam deal with the Pasuk? Right? In other words, if we really take the Rambam at face value, that a Tzar is absolutely equal to a Kohen when it comes to lighting the menorah, right? And, you know, if we could set it up logistically so that the Tzar would have access to the menorah, he's just as good as a Kohen to light the menorah. So then why Taki in the Pasuk does it say, Daver Elad of Yomar Tzoreilov, Baloscha Es Haneiros? Right? In other words, the Ibn Ezra is picking up on a Diyuk, not even a fairly obvious Diyuk from the Pasuk. The mitzvah of Hadlokas Haner is addressed to Aaron. It would seem to imply that the mitzvah of Hadlokas HaMenorah is the mitzvah of the Kohanim, not of anybody else. So how does the Rambam deal with the Pasuk? Right? So there's a beautiful pshat, again it's not an Ibn Ezra pshat, but the beautiful pshat of Meshech Chochma. Meshech Chochma suggests, Meir Simcha Cohen suggests, that although the Gemara says that generally speaking a Tzar is allowed to light the menorah, again, according to the Rambam's interpretation, the first time the menorah is kindled, it has to be by a Kohen, not even just by a Kohen, it has to be by Aaron HaKohen Dasko. Why? Because we find with regards to the Klei HaMikdash, the Avodasa Mechankasa, that the way the Kalim become Kadosh is through the performance of that activity which is associated with the Kalim. It's true that generally speaking, the menorah can be lit by a Tzar, but that first time, which is not just an avoda, or not just an activity, but it's something which confers kedusha upon the menorah, that first time of kindling the menorah has to be done by Aaron HaKohen. And the truth is, the Meshech Chochma's pshat happens to work very nicely in the Sukkim. The ha'aloscha es haneros, when you raise up the neros, in other words, when you get the show on the road, in other words, when you start this activity, when you inaugurate the menorah, you should, you know, this is how you're supposed to do it. It was a one-time activity. Aaron went, and he kindled the menorah, and then his mitzvah was done. Thereafter, a Tzar is allowed to go in and light the menorah as much as he wants. The whole beginning of Parshas Baaloscha is about the Chanukas HaMenorah, not necessarily about the ongoing mitzvah of the lighting of the menorah.
Also, only one of two places that the menorah is spelled
Molech. Oh, very interesting. So the menorah is written Molech.
Right.
So why is it written Molech? Because this is the inauguration, so it's the full-fledged menorah. Right, very, very nice.
So why can't you imagine we talking about that also? why do you have to say that he's taking the side of the righteous? Because he could be saying that the
Nitzvot
is one planet.
Right. So, in other words, could the Ibn Ezra be interpreted as saying the same thing as the Meshech Chochmah? You know, that we're talking about the inauguration of the menorah as opposed to the ongoing Nitzvah of the Halakhah of the menorah. I'll tell you the truth. Originally, I was thinking something along those lines. I'm not sure how well it really fits into the Lashon of the Ibn Ezra. The Ibn Ezra's Lashon is, Yehu Chayav, the Mitzvah Halakhah Haner. The pasuk and mitzvah halakas haner is the ongoing mitzvah of.
So, in other words, the pasuk is referring to the tivoi.
Right.
So it's referring to obviously only this one time tivoi.
Right, right. But in other words, according to the Meshech Chochmah, it's not really the mitzvah of Hadlokas Hamir. You know, you would say, Kihu Chai is the mitzvah Chinuch HaMenorah, Chanukas HaMenorah, or something of that nature. In other words, to be as terse as the Ibn Ezra is, and then try to read into that this Mechudishtik of Shas of Meshech Chochmah, to me, you know, seems like a little bit of a stretch. And it seems to me much easier to assume that the Ibn Ezra is understanding like the Ravid, that the ongoing mitzvah of Halakas Haner is something that's incumbent upon the Kohanim, and the only chiddush of the Gemara is that b'diavad, if the Zohar lit it, you know, the menorah would not be nitzel of the kash, it, you know, wouldn't be disqualified as such. Presumably, yeah. In other words, I believe that's what would follow from Mr. Hoffman. Yeah, in other words, any time they break in any new clear in the Mikros, you know, it would be, you know, incumbent upon the Kohen to do it. Say again. So, in other words, let's say, and they happen to be doing it outside of the Kodesh for whatever reason.
So, does that mean that the Kohen would have to do it?
According, in other words, if you merge Reb Chaim's pshat with the Meshech Chochmah's pshat, right, it's hard to know. I don't know if those pshat are necessarily meant to be merged together, right? In other words, you know, the Meshech Chochmah is saying a chiluk between first time versus other times. Reb Chaim is saying a chiluk versus, you know, in terms of the location of the menorah. I don't know if you can necessarily just, you know, put the pshat them together in that way. Yeah. I think according to Meshech Chochmah, it would require, but I'm not sure that Reb Chaim would see that as being significant. Yeah.
What would be specific about the lighting of the menorah that so much effort would be involved in trying to say that it should be done by a god? The coin was late, his train was late.
Well, in point of fact, I doubt that the menorah was ever lit by a zohar. Right. But again, you know, l'may nafkamina. In other words, you know, the question is not a historical one, whether it was lit by a zohar, but it's just but a halakhic one, is could it be lit by a zohar? Right? So there is a hashkafic question behind that. In other words, you know, why should it be that the menorah could be lit by a zohar? Wouldn't you think that that is very much something that the Kohanim, you know, should be charged with doing? Apparently, you know, creating the light is not as central to the idea of the menorah as we might have thought. I mean, that's what apparently what emerges from this. Right, but you're right. I mean, historically, I imagine it was rare, if it ever happened, that a czar was, you know, actually in a position where he was going and lighting the menorah.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's one Ha'ara, you know, the very beginning of the Sedra, where there is an answer, again, in a very quiet way, without telling us, you know, without waving any flags, you know, seems to be wading into the middle of a Machlokes HaRishona. Then, moving forward a little bit into the Sedra, we find in Perek Yud, the mitzvah of Chatzotra, of the trumpets which are supposed to be blown at various points. So among the tasks which the Chatzotros have, the Pasuk describes in Perek Yud Pasuk Tes the following. The Chisavau Milchama Be'arzichem Al Hashar HaSorereschem. When you engage in war in your land against an enemy who's attacking you, you should blow a trua, right, a staccato sound with the chasosos, then you count them. You will then be remembered before Hashem your God, and you will be saved from your enemies. Right? So the blowing of the chasosos at times of war will enable Klal Yisrael to be saved from their enemies. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will listen to us at that time. Why is that the case? Right? Why is blowing trumpets going to cause us to be saved from our enemies? So Ibn Ezra over here writes that then it's count them. Why will you be remembered? Very interesting shot. Why will Hashem answer you? Because you did what he said. Hashem said when an enemy comes, you should blow the chatzotzos. So you did it. So the source of listening to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you'll be saved. It's a very interesting shot, right? In other words, had HaKadosh Baruch Hu had said, you know, set off firecrackers, and you did that. You know, in other words, according to this shot, there's nothing inherent about the blowing of chatzotzos that causes Klal Yisrael to be remembered. You know, in times of war, it's just that you should do something to, you know, to show your allegiance to the Dvar Hashem, and that alone will be enough to, you know, to bring about your salvation.
You don't really see any place where we're doing anything, any kind of mitzvah, any kind of Sivri Hashem, where the Sivri Hashem doesn't have meaning beyond just the act of listening to
ourselves. Right. I mean, that's why this is such a striking Ibn Ezra, because Ibn Ezra seems to be saying that the value of blowing the chatzotzos is simply because Hashem said blow the chatzotzos. Right? Very interesting shot. He then provides another shot, which I think is a little bit easier to understand, at least for me, it's a little bit easier to understand, but also I think it's a great insight into the idea of trua. Gam ha-trua zecher la-nefoshos l'tzok l'Hashem. A trua specifically is a reminder to people to call out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We know that the trua is defined by the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah as alternatively ganuche gonach or yalula yolal, right? In other words, it's described either as a groaning sound or as a whimpering sound. So again, we're all familiar with that. That's, you know, the whole issue is the trua, is the Torah's trua, what we call the shvarim, is the Torah's trua, what we call the trua. So maybe what we call the shvarim's trua, right? But why altogether would a trua be identified as the sound of either moaning or whimpering? What's the idea behind that? Comes to Ibn Ezra and he says, trua is the sound which is supposed to elicit prayer from the people who hear it. Right? That is, when you hear a trua, you're supposed to be motivated and moved to pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right? In a certain sense, without saying it, the Ibn Ezra is referencing the famous Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah. How is it that when Klal Yisrael fought against Amalek and Moshe Rabbeinu raised his hands, magically the Jewish people, you know, were victorious? And how is it that when Klal Yisrael were bitten by snakes And Moshe Rabbeinu takes a copper snake and places it on a pole, and the people look up to it. Quote unquote, magically, the people are healed. You know, the chiyodos of Moshe, hosos melchama, shovros melchama. What? The hands go up, the war is won. The hands go down, you know, the war is lost. Rather, the Mishnah famously says, when Klal Yisrael, this was a signal for Klal Yisrael to engage in tefillah, to pour out their hearts before HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right? In other words, they would lift up their eyes to heaven, and that signal enabled them to be saved. In a sense, the Ibn Ezra is saying something very similar about the Chatzotzos. The Chatzotzos, what is the value of Chatzotzos when you go out to war? The sound of the Truah gets you to daven, and it's the davening that will enable you to be saved, you know, during the course of the fight. The Chatzotzos are a means to an end, you know, they're not an end in themselves. We know that there's a tremendous amount of wonders when it comes to the shofar of Rosh Hashanah, that the shofar in many ways is considered to be a tefillah. Right? That's why, you know, at least in the Rabbanon, the shofar is not supposed to be sounded independently. The shofar is supposed to be sounded al Seder HaBrachos. It's supposed to be, you know, integrated into the Shemoneh Esrei, certainly the Chazar HaShas, maybe the Shiva Shemoneh Esrei, depending on where you're davening exactly. Right, so this whole idea of shofar being tefillah is an interesting one. Because somebody standing up there blowing a shofar, that's called tefillah? How is that called tefillah? Ibn Ezra gives us a little bit of insight into that. The shofar is a goreim for me to daven. The shofar causes me to be moved, me, the listener, and it helps me daven in a way in which I wouldn't have davened as well without the sound of the shofar. When you hear the sound of wailing, of whimpering, of groaning, whatever it happens to be, you know, a typical person is moved. And when you're moved, you daven, and when you daven, you know, so, Hashem, we get results. So that this very, very short comment of the Ibn Ezra, I think, you know, is very, very helpful just in terms of putting the whole mitzvah of Tkiyas Shofar into a certain perspective.
Well, maybe another goal is because it's talking about when you're acting out of control. When you're behaving, there's an attack is showing by it. And obviously, it's talking about a time when we're not behaving.
Right.
That's why you have to go to
right.
To get you to cry.
Right. So in other words, there's a tshuva element, you know, in the blowing of the tshuva as well. Right. Okay.
If from the
Sabbath. Okay.
The heat of that under normal circumstances, certainly today, we don't have time for tefillah. And therefore, the message here is that it's what we call up.
Right.
So, times the tefillah, you don't have a possibility.
Because this is the tefillah. Interesting. I think it's an interesting shot. I don't know if you can read it into the Ibn Ezra, but you know, I think you can say it independently.
Right.
It could be. He had a hard life. It could be that, right. But in other words, you know, what you want to suggest is that the Chatzotzos and the Truah perhaps takes the place of Tefillah, you know, due to the fact that people in the heat of war may be unable, you know, to be able to daven properly, to daven thoroughly. Right, so I definitely hear that. Again, the lashon of the Ibn Ezra is Hatzruah Zecher LaNefashos Tzolk Lashem. I think within the Ibn Ezra is suggesting that the Truah, which is sounded from the Chatzotzos, the Shas Melchama, is supposed to encourage the participants, you know, to dive into Hashem. Now again, it may be a very short tefillah, you know, it may be a very impromptu kind of tefillah, like God save us. It may be as simple as all of that, right? But, you know, some degree of expressed tefillah, you know, I think the Ibn Ezra is assuming that would be expressed at that time.
All right, the Catholic Russian language and the Catholic.
Yeah.
Doesn't it say, because we blow the shofar for
a year? Right. You talk a shofar, but you have Amlo Yechirodu.
Right.
Right.
So, the part. It's impossible once you get a show for the year.
Right, you can't not respond to someone. Right.
So that
It will certainly, you know, be covering that that degree of contrition. Again, it may be a very silent kind of prayer. It may be, you know, the prayer which just goes through the person's head. And again, God save us. And maybe it's just as simple as that. But, you know, to have some kind of hisorerus that's going to come about, you know, some kind of arousal that will come out because of the shrua. Right, so the Ibn Ezra isn't saying that you need chatzotzos in order to daven, right? But he is saying that the chatzotzos do have that effect. In other words, what's that? Right, so that's some of the Mepharshim say, that, you know, they cried out, I think the Sivrites like that, they cried out in Mitzrayim without a formal tefillah. They just, you know, and that also was considered to be something. Right, the Lashon of the Ibn Ezra is Litzok. Litzok also could be interpreted as a very primitive kind of tefillah, just the welling up of the feelings of the heart. That for sure could be interpreted as well. The following pasuk also has a very fascinating interpretation from the Ibn Ezra. So the next pasuk says, "Uviyom simchaschem uvemoradechem uvelashechoshechem, on the day of your happiness and on your holidays and on Rosh Chodesh, uskatim bechatzotzot alaloshechem alzimchei shalmechem. You should sound the chatzotzot when you bring the karbanos. V'hayu lachem l'zikarim l'snei alokeichem. They should be a source of remembrance before your God. Ani Hashem alokeichem. What's beyond simchaschem uvemoadechem?" Right? So, Chazal interpret, what's that? Right? So, Chazal interpret that Moadechem is Yom Tovim, right? Yom simchaschem is Shabbos. And then, you know, the pasuk reads, "Yom Simchaschem u'Moadechem v'Rosh Chodeshechem," on Shabbos, Yom Tov, or Rosh Chodesh, when you bring korbanos, you should blow the chatzotzos. Right? There's an interesting discussion about the relevance of Simcha to Shabbos, Yom Simchaschem and Shabbos. Right? So it would seem that although there's a question whether there's a mitzvah of Simcha on Shabbos or not, in the Mikdash, there is a concept of Simcha on Shabbos. That's what Yosef there is. That's how I used to explain that Nusach Ashkenaz says the line Yismachu v'malchuscha shomrei Shabbos dafkut musaf. Doesn't work in Nusach Sfar, right? But in Nusach Ashkenaz we have to say the line Yismachu v'malchuscha shomrei Shabbos han, you know, at musaf, because musaf is the tefillah that parallels the Beit HaMikdash, and in the Mikdash is the mitzvah of Simcha on Shabbos. Okay. The Ibn Ezra, however, gives an entirely different interpretation. What's the Yom Simchatzah v'Moadechem? Sheshavtem ne'eret oyev. When you came back from fighting the enemy, when you won the war. And again, on a pshat level, the two psukim connect very nicely. The previous pasuk was when you went out to war, you blew chatzotzos. Now, this pasuk is talking about when you come back from war and you were victorious, you should also blow chatzotzos. Only tzachtem ha'oyev ha'bo aleichem. You know, either you went out to war and were victorious, or when the enemy invaded, you drove the enemy back, and you were also victorious. So what's that got to do with anything? Says the Ezra, who k'vachtem yom simcha, ki mei purim v'shivash yimei chis ki yom simcha. Uviyom simchatzem v'moadechem, says the Ibn Ezra, means on the day of rejoicing that you proclaimed as a holiday to mark your military victory. Uviyom simchatzem v'moadechem, uschatzem v'chatzotzos. What's an example of this? Says the Ibn Ezra, Purim. Right? Purim is a celebration, not so much of a military victory, but of a victory against the enemy, and it's a non-military. Well, I guess in some ways a military victory against the enemy, right? But not a typical military victory against the enemy. What? Right. It's just not typical in the sense that it was a fight against terror. It wasn't a fight between countries, right? In the typical, it wasn't an army. It was the Jews fighting against terrorists. But Uviyom Tzuchatzim Wadeh says to Ibn Ezra, is the source in Chumash for the idea of making a holiday to mark a nitzachon, a victory, against those who would seek to destroy us. I think Rishol Yisraeli quotes this Ibn Ezra in the context of talking about Yom HaShmaut. Right? In other words, where do you get this idea that you could, you know, make a holiday, you know, because we were victorious? So he quotes this Ibn Ezra. You see, there's an idea in Chumash of making a holiday to mark a victory. Certainly, this would be yet another makar for the idea of Purim min HaTorah. In other words, where do you come to the idea of making days like Purim and Hanukkah, you know, min HaTorah itself? The Torah, according to the Pasuk of Shas of Ibn Ezra, gives license to Klal Yisrael, or not even gives license, assumes that Klal Yisrael would make days of days to mark a victory against the enemy, and that we would even blow chatzotzos on such a day. Now, again, one last ha'ara, and then we'll down in Irish. What would they blow? How would they blow the chatzotzos on these days of victory? Uskatim the chatzotzos. They blow a tkira. A tkira is a broken sound. It's a sound that indicates that things are going badly. We need to daven. But when we're victorious, we blow a tkira to show that everything is well. The message of the tkiyas on Rosh Hashanah alternates between the tkiyas and the truas. We have to realize that we're in danger, but there's also a certain confidence that we have on Rosh Hashanah that we're going to be judged properly. Hence, every trua we blow on Rosh Hashanah is enveloped by a tkiyah beforehand and a tkiyah afterwards. We're not despondent on Rosh Hashanah. We have a certain sense of confidence that things are going to work out okay. Okay, we'll pick up one more ha'ara after Myra's. Welcome to part two of the Shir Ibn Ezra and Parshas Baaloscha. I wanted to share an Ibn Ezra that provides a perspective on some of the storyline of the Torah that's very, very different than what we normally assume, and causes us to take a different look at things that we're used to seeing. So in Perek Yud, Pasuk Chavtes, Pasuk says, "Vayomer Moshe." Moshe said, "L'chovav ben Reuel hanigyani chosein Moshe." Moshe spoke to Chovav, the son of Reuel of Midian, the chosein of Moshe. He said, "We're on the way to Eretz Yisrael. Come with us." And Chovav declines this offer. Who is Chovav? Rashi writes, Chovav. Who Yisrael, right? Chovav is one of the names that Yisrael has. In fact, you know, the Chovav who's being referred to over here is none other than Yisrael, the Chosein Moshe, the father-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu. Comes to Ibn Ezra with a different shot. Right? To Ibn Ezra, Motsanu Shetzipora Hibas Reuel. We find in Chumash that Tzipora, the wife of Moshe, is the daughter of Reuel, a man named Reuel. Him called Suba, he tended to see Parabita. Right? In other words, in Parashat Shmos, when Moshe first encounters Tzipora, it says, "Atavona el Reuel Avien," right? The daughters of the Kohen of Midian come back to their father. The father's name is Reuel. Right? So, you know, Tzipora's father was named Reuel. That's what the Pasuk says. He Yehovah, who ben Reuel. So this Chovav, who's referred to over here, is the son of Reuel. He named Achiz Tzipora. What would come out, therefore, is that Chovav is none other than Tzipora's brother, i.e. Moshe Rabbeinu's brother-in-law. So it stands to reason, says the Ibn Ezra, that Chovav and Yisrael are one and the same person. In that regard, Ibn Ezra agrees with Rashi in the classical interpretation of Chazal that Yisrael and Chovav are the same person. However, Reuel is a different person. And according to Ibn Ezra, it comes out that Yisrael was actually Moshe Rabbeinu's brother-in-law, not his father-in-law. Right? Oh, so what does it say? Oh, so continues the Ibn Ezra. The im yitzon hatzoin ki hakosuv omar al yitzro chosein Moshe. If someone will come along. See, the Ibn Ezra had a stick in the vua, right? If someone will come along and say, "Aye, but the Pasuk says that Yitzro was the chosein Moshe, the father-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu," So how can you tell me that Chovav equals Yisrael, but Chovav is the brother-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu? By the way, it says in our pasuk also, Chovav is Chosei Moshe. Although there you could deflect it and say that maybe it's one of Reuel. Chovav, comma, then Reuel, Chosei Moshe. Okay, but certainly it says about Yisrael that he was Chosei Moshe. So the Ibn Ezra comes out with the following, Yesh Lahashiv. Ki derech hamikro likro avi hanara ve'ochira chosei. The chosei just means an in-law, right? Much the same way that we use the term mechutin today in a much looser sense. Mechutin kind of means someone who's related to you through marriage, right? It doesn't necessarily always mean the exact same relationship. So says the Ibn Ezra, that's built into the word chosein in Hebrew. Chosein means an in-law, right? It can mean a father-in-law, it can mean a brother-in-law, but it's not limited to a particular type of in-law relationship. If so, so according to the Ibn Ezra, when Parshas Yisro talks about Yisro chosein Moshe, really the proper way to translate that phrase is Yisro, the brother-in-law, of Moshe Rabbeinu. So the Ibn Ezra afterwards goes on to quote the more what to us is the more conventional pshat. The Rabbim Amru, many say Shechovav hu Yisro, that indeed Chovav is Yisro, but who avi Tzipora, but Chovav slash Yisro is the father of Tzipora, Uruel hayaz the Kena. Right, and Reuel was her grandfather, and Zachovona Reuel Avian, you know, means that they came to the grandfather Reuel, right? And you know, that's also a legitimate way of doing things. Then he says the Chachomenu Amru Shiva Shemos Hayulo Yisrael, right? He quotes the famous Maimer Chazal that everybody, Yisrael is everybody. Reuel is Yisrael. Yisrael is Yisrael. Yeser is Yisrael. Chovav is Yisrael. You know, he was also Yisrael, right? So in other words, everybody's Yisrael, right? He had many credit cards, Yisrael, right? So you know, so he quotes that from Chazal, and then the Ezra concludes with the famous phrase, the Shivim Panim LaTorah. Right? By the way, so Shivim Panim LaTorah, there are 70 different ways of looking at Torah. L'chora, the way that Ibn Ezra is using the phrase over here means there are 70 ways of looking at Torah, even when the different ways are clearly mutually exclusive. Meaning, it's pretty clear that Yisro is not simultaneously the father-in-law of Moshe and the brother-in-law of Moshe. I mean, in other words, he's one or the other. I don't think you can reconcile the various pshatim one with another. Shivan Panim LaTorah doesn't mean that everybody's right, and which is why he doesn't use the term Elu Ve'elu Divrei Elokim Chayim, which Elu Ve'elu Divrei Elokim Chayim means that both pshatim on some level are ultimately correct. Here, L'chora, somebody's right and somebody's wrong. In reality, in other words, Yisro was either the brother-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu or the father-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu. It's hard to say that he was both. It's hard to figure out how you'd be able to make him both. Shivim Panim LaTorah just means that there are legitimate justifications for each of these pirushim, right? And each of these pirushim is Torah insofar as they represent an honest effort to figure out what the psukim mean. But l'chora, they're not all factually correct. And l'chora, you have to say like that, because otherwise, you know, how would they all be factually correct? I'm not sure how you'd be able to explain it that way. So again, l'chora, that's why the Ibn Ezra says, Shivim Panim LaTorah, you know, there's 70 different ways of interpreting a pasuk, all of which could be legitimate interpretations, even though they may not be factually right. They're all being factually right would be expressed through Elu Ve'elu Divrei Elokim Chayim, that on some level, you know, whether the item is Tahor or Tameh are equally correct. Let's go back for a moment to this chapter of the Ibn Ezra, which is very, very unique, that Yisrael is in fact the brother-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu rather than the father-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu. If we accept that chapter, it adds, not that we need to, but it adds, I think, even more to the tremendous image we have of Moshe Rabbeinu, you know, how impressive a person Moshe Rabbeinu was and how much of an honor he was. Right? When we read Parshas Yisro, and Yisro, the father-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu, comes along, and you see the covet with which Moshe Rabbeinu treats him. You know, he goes after him, he bows down before him, he shows him such covet. The Shver comes along and makes a suggestion, and instead of Moshe Rabbeinu saying, you know, why don't you come anyway? You know, well, why don't you go back to where you came from? So Moshe Rabbeinu accepts the suggestion, incorporates the suggestion. You know, it's really, you know, all of the beginning of Parshas Yisro is a tremendous tribute to the, you know, to the anivus of Moshe Rabbeinu, the readiness of Moshe Rabbeinu to learn from anyone. But all of that is so much more true if Yisro is the brother-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu. I mean, Mela, your father-in-law comes, and he has an idea, and you treat it with covet, and you indulge the idea. Okay, Leila, your brother-in-law comes, and he wants to reorganize the whole way that, you know, you're running the machane yourself. Who invited you? You know, I have no particular need, you know, to show covet to my brother-in-law. So if you go for this interpretation, it's an answer. Again, it just shows you how much more so that Moshe Rabbeinu was ready to learn from everyone who is mamish, as the Pasuk says, and this requires the honor of Nikol HaAdam, you know, tremendous, tremendous greatness and humility. Again, an idea which is really just brought out in a beautiful way by this pshat, even though the pshat happens to be a rather unconventional one in terms of how we understand the psukim. Okay, I just wanted to bring out that area, and next week we'll pick up, next week actually we will not meet Wednesday night, so Tuesday night? Tuesday night's better for people. Let's make it Tuesday night, okay? Then we'll go.